Galatians 4. We're going to read verse 6 and 7 just to get the context of where we were. And because ye are sons, God has sent forth the Spirit of His Son into your hearts, crying, Abba, Father. Wherefore thou art no more a servant, but a son, and if a son, then an heir of God through Christ. Now, keep this in mind. If you know somebody real well, after a while, your relationship with them becomes more complex. What do you mean by that? Well, your spouse can be your friend, okay? Your spouse might be your working partner, okay? Your working partner might be a friend. In other words, relationships, there's often more to it than just a simple one-on-one relationship. So the Apostle Paul talks here, you're no more a servant but a son, but yet in other places say, I'm a servant of Jesus Christ, okay? So again, a relationship with God is complex and needs to be looked at. How are we speaking of this relationship, okay? You know, let's say that, a 12-year-old boy and his mother, they sit and play a game of checkers, a Monopoly together, and they're friends, they're playing a game, it's a lot of fun, all right? But he can't walk by later and slap her on the butt saying, how you doing, Toots, all right? That's not going to fly, all right? That relationship's been pushed the wrong way, all right? Right. Just in time. Galatians chapter 4, verses 6 and 7.
Okay.
All right. The point of that is keep relationships clear for what's going on, what's happening at the time. Okay. All right. Now it goes on and it says this, verse 8. Howbeit then, when ye knew not God, ye did service unto them which by nature are no gods. Okay. I am recording, yes. Let me just make sure it's going. Yes, it's still going. So the thing is, you did by nature. You served them that were no gods. Let me put on airplane mode so nobody calls and interrupts. All right. What do we mean by, in other words, what are the people out there, what is an animist? I don't know if anybody knows what an animist is. An animist are people, we often think of them as tribal type people who worship the spirits and the flowers and, you know, hippie type of thing or whatever. And it's amazing because people want to worship something, okay? They'll make idols and worship them. They'll make up legends and worship them and everything else. So the Apostle Paul says, when you knew not God, you worshiped these other things, which were by nature, they're not gods, but you worship them. Verse 9, but now, after that ye have known God, or rather are known of God, how turn ye again to the weak and beggarly elements, whereby ye desire to be again in bondage? Now, what a turn of the phrase. You know God, and he says you're known of God. Now, that's what a relationship with God is like. Okay, if you're born again, you're known of God. He knows you, knows all about you. That's good sometimes, that's bad sometimes, all right? But he knows all about you. So the thing is, he's saying, then why are you turning again to the weak and beggarly elements? What do you mean by that? Why are you suddenly, and he's going to go into that here again in a bit, but keep this in mind, there's nothing you can do with your flesh that's going to bring you closer to God. There's things you can do with your flesh that'll get you farther away from God. All right? But there's nothing you're going to do with your flesh that's going to bring you closer to God. So he goes on, he says, verse 10, you observe days. What is it? Well, this is a holy day. I have to keep it holy. Nothing like that in the New Testament. You observe days and months and times and years. I am afraid of you, lest I have bestowed upon you labor in vain. What happened? The Jewish believers came in and got these people all interested in partial Judaism again. That idea, for example, the worst people of that today are the Seventh-day Adventists. who really try to get people, they try to get them eating more, get rid of your shellfish, don't eat, pork. They keep Saturday for the Sabbath and such. And Saturday is the Sabbath. But we don't keep the Sabbath, okay? Go with me, keep your finger there, but go to Acts chapter 18. We'll just start verse 1 of Acts chapter 18. After these things, Paul departed from Athens and came to Corinth and found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, lately come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because that Claudius had commanded all Jews to depart from Rome and came unto them. And because he was of the same craft, he abode with them and wrought, for by their occupation they were tent makers. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath. What day are the Jews in the synagogue?
Saturday.
Then why did the Holy Ghost call that the Sabbath? Because Saturday's the Sabbath. Okay? It didn't change because Jesus rose on a Sunday. All right? You'll hear a lot of Christians say, well, Sunday's the Sabbath now. Why did God set the seventh day apart for rest? Why? Anybody remember?
Didn't he rest on that day?
That's exactly right. God rested on that day. Did God rest on Sunday? No, he did the greatest work he ever did on Sunday. All right? He raised Jesus Christ from the dead. Sunday is not the Sabbath. Okay? Now, I don't take jobs on Sunday. Why? Because that's the day the house of God meets together. Okay? Randy will come to me. You want me to mow lawn today? It doesn't bother me if he mows lawn when church is over. All right? There's people who would have been aghast at that, old Lutherans or Methodists or something. They would have seen that as a desecration of the Sabbath because you're mowing lawn on a Sunday and such. That Sunday is not the Sabbath. Saturday's the Sabbath, but we don't keep the Sabbath. In fact, the Apostle Paul said, if you kept days and months and years, my labor on you would be in vain to do that. There'd be no point in what I've taught you. All right. Goes on, he says in verse 12, brethren, we're in Galatians 4 again now. Brethren, I beseech you, be as I am. For I am as ye are, and ye have not injured me at all. So what's one of the things the Apostle Paul said? He said in Corinthians that when he was with the Jews, he acted as a Jew amongst the Gentiles and Gentiles. Is he being phony or hypocritical? No. In other words, you know, if I was trying to witness to a Jewish household, you think I'm going to walk in there with a big handful of bacon and eating it or something? No, I'm not going to do that. Why? Because it's offensive to them. Okay? I'm not going to do that. I'm going to try to do what makes them comfortable. So the Apostle Paul says, be as I am. For I am as ye are, and ye haven't hurt me at all, me being that way. The life I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God. I'm not living it by touch not, taste not, or days I keep. That isn't how I'm serving God anymore. And then he goes and he says this, verse 13, you know how that through infirmity of the flesh, I preached the gospel unto you at the first. God never made it easy for Paul. His flesh had infirmity while he's preaching. It was never easy for him. There was never a time when he woke up, just an easy day to go get this done. Verse 14, and my temptation which was in my flesh, ye despised not nor rejected, but received me as an angel of God, even as Christ Jesus. So when Paul came, they could see suffering in the flesh. They can see that and he's like, well, he can't be of God. Look what's going on here. Didn't do that at all. Okay? They received him as an angel of God. Look at this. This is wonderful. And they received him as Christ Jesus. Why? He's speaking in Jesus Christ's stead. You know, I'll never forget listening to Jesse Miller preach. And somebody said, you just got to listen to this. You got to listen to this. So they put Jesse Miller on. Well, Jesse Miller had run a servicemen's center in Athens, Greece for years and left just before I got there. So all these people knew him. I didn't know Jesse Miller. And when they put this tape on, I thought, well, I can't listen to this guy. He talked like this. The words just didn't come out. Very well. He'd been tortured by the Japanese and lived in their prison camps for so long. And he could hardly speak. And yet, we weren't 5 minutes into the message and I forgot everything about how he talked. I mean, it is absolutely the power of God was on every word that he said. But see, Jesse Miller, on December 7th, 1941, was in the Philippines. Keep in mind, they're one day ahead of us, so it was December 8th that they got hit. He and his buddy went down to the beach in the Philippines, and they got on their knees and said, God, our life is too easy. Make it hell so that we can show other people heaven. And he survived the Bataan Death March. He survived Japanese prison camps. Survived all those things. And had an infirmity of his flesh. And helped many, many people. As I say, when I first started to listen, I thought, I can't listen to this guy. And 5 minutes later, I didn't even hear the speech problems. Just the power with which he spoke. Not long after World War II, he was in the Philippines, and he wanted to go up and see a place where he used to be in a prison camp. And they told him, you can't go up there. It's held by communist rebels. And he went anyway. And sure enough, they instantly captured him and his buddies, the communist rebels. And when they heard he'd been held by the Japanese, they all saluted him, let him go. All right. So he goes on, he says this, verse 15, where is then the blessedness ye spake of? For I bear record that if it had been possible, you would have plucked out your own eyes and have given them to me. Now, when he first came, they talked about what a blessing, Paul, you're here, how wonderful. How much did they love him? Apparently he had eye problems because he said, you would have taken your own eyes out and given them to me if you could have done it. That's quite a bit of love. I remember one time, there was a controversy in the early 80s whether or not organ donation was a thing Christians could do. And I remember asking Bill Randall about it. He said, what did Paul say? You would have taken your eyes out and given them to me. He didn't say that was bad. In other words, nothing wrong with organ donation. Nothing wrong with that at all.
Good old Bill Randall.
Yep. Verse 16, am I therefore become your enemy because I tell you the truth? All right. And a lot of times, you know, in fact, I've often said it. You can come up and insult me. It doesn't bother me unless it's a true insult. Then I'm really a tore up. That bothers me a lot. Verse 17, they zealously affect you. Who? These other people that have come in and they're trying to get you now to follow Sabbaths, get you circumcised, get you to do this stuff. They zealously affect you, okay? But not well. Yea, they would exclude you that you might affect them. Now that's an important verse. Let me explain that. I don't know if you've ever seen a bunch of kids have a club. You know, the kids have a club. Hey, we'll have this club. This tree house here. Only the cool guys can come in it, all right? And there's always some kid in the neighborhood that's not allowed in, you know? And he tries to come in. Why don't they allow him in? Because it makes them look better, all right? See, we have a cool club here. They exclude you that you might affect them. Now they see it's really exclusive. We didn't let Chris in, you see, or, and such. But the point is there, the Apostle Paul said these Judaizers, they would love to exclude you that you might affect them. It makes them look more holy. They don't let people like you around. And you watch for that kind of thing. I've had to tell Dale that a few times with people that reject him and such. They would exclude you that you might affect them. See? Mm-hmm. All right. And he goes on and he says this, verse 18. But it is good to be zealously affected always in a good thing. And not only when I am present with you. Okay? You know, one of the things the Apostle Paul talks about is eye service. Behaving when people are watching you, but not when they're not watching. Bob Jones Sr. always used to say that the measure of your personal character is what you're like when no one's watching you. That's the true measure of your personal character. Anybody can have good personal character when people are watching them. But it's when no one's watching you. You're on your own. What are you then? Okay. So he says, it's good to be zealously affected always in a good thing, not only when I am present with you. My little children, of whom I had travail and birth again until Christ be formed in you. You know, when a person gets saved, it's a wonderful thing. It's great. It's like a newborn baby at the hospital. Is there ever any more joy than that? You know, that newborn baby, and I mean, it's just such a wonderful thing, and everyone's so happy and such. But then the reality hits. Oh, it cries at weird hours of the night, all right? It drains fluids out like every orifice in its body, and it's, you know, it's they're odd like that, babies are. So the point is, the same thing happens. When a person gets saved, it's a wonderful thing, but then you labor until Christ is fully formed in that person. Till they have learned to allow Jesus Christ to run every aspect of their life. All right. Verse 20. I desire to be present with you now and to change my voice, for I stand in doubt of you. He says, you know, I've heard these things about you. I'd like to be around you and change how I'm talking, but right now I'm in doubt of you guys. You guys really make me wonder. You've been overthrown by these people? Verse 21, tell me, ye that desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondwoman, the other by a free woman. Now what he's about to do is give you an allegory. What do we mean by that? The tortoise and the hare, okay? In fact, let me give you another example. I remember one time we were out planting potatoes in the side yard, and my father had us all out there working, and some way or another, my sister slipped out of the work. And we all got to the table, because back in those days, my father would drive in, and be about 5 minutes to five. My father would drive in from Little Valley. He'd pull in. You could almost time your watch. If he wasn't, there was a flat tire or something. And, you know, he'd pull in, and that meant one beer at the Birdwalk, you know, on 242, and then drive into the driveway. And then my mother would set the table, and I would just clockwork. So we all sit down. He gets a report from my mother, and all of a sudden he says, Melinda, tell us the story of the little red hen. And he made her tell the entire story of the little red hen. And she's just flushed. She's red. You know, she knows where this is going and such. And when she got done, he just said, would you like to eat some of those potatoes when we're done? He said, would you like to, you know, have some of the corn and such when it's done and such? Now, the point is, was there really a little red hen? No. Okay, that's an allegorical story. So that when a person listens to it, there's a deeper truth involved here than just a funny story about a hen. Okay. Do you know the story of the little red hen, Randy? Okay, you know what I just realized? There's probably some others that don't also. In other words, what happened with the little red hen when she wanted to go plant some wheat, she asked all the other animals, nobody wanted to help her, okay? Then she asked if anybody wanted to weed. No, nobody wanted to help weed, all right? Then anybody want to help me pick it? Nobody wanted to help pick it. Anybody want to help me sift the flour? Nobody wanted to help sift the flour. Anybody want to help me break the bread? Nobody wanted to help. Anybody want to help me bake the bread? Eat the bread. Oh, they all wanted to help eat the bread. She said, oh, no. You didn't help plant it. You didn't help pick it. You didn't help weed it. You didn't help sift it. You're not having any of the bread. That's the story of the little red hen, all right?
Nailed down for me.
Yep, there you are. There are many such stories of that. Now, listen. What the Apostle Paul is about to do, he's about to take a true Bible story, and he's about to make an allegory out of it. This has caused liberals to say then there probably wasn't really an Abraham or a Sarah. Okay? In other words, they say that those are just myths and allegories from time past. Okay? That's how most people look at it. One of the miracles to the Bible is that God can take all those stories in the book of Genesis and all of them have profound allegorical New Testament applications. The more you look at it, the more you see, okay? Joseph and his brethren, what did they do? They put him in a pit with no water, okay? What did happen to Jesus Christ? They killed him and he went out into hell, all right? What did that happen then? Pharaoh took him, put him at his right hand. What happened to Jesus Christ? He sits at the right hand of God. Why does he do that? Because then his brethren come to him and he saves his brethren. So all of these Genesis stories have allegorical application to the New Testament. It's one of the fascinating things to see.
I've never put those two together.
Okay. There are preachers who preach nothing but what we call that typology. Okay? Joseph being a type of Jesus Christ. Okay? Goliath being a type of maybe sin. All right? David conquers this huge giant. So you can take these stories and you can make the ark, all right? A man-made thing that saves the world is made out of wood. Well, what's the cross? A man-made thing made out of wood that saves the world. All right, so the thing is, you can take and make allegorical statements out of that Old Testament all over the place. The miracle to that is these are all stories that really happened, okay? Which also, and the people participating in these stories had no idea how that their lives then could be examined and the truths of the New Testament would come out of them. Keep this in mind, the Jews who wrote down those stories certainly had no idea the New Testament was going to come along. All right? They had no idea of that. And the more you study it, it really is profound. Some of that, when you go into it, begin to look at the typology. It's what we call spiritualizing a passage. You don't take the passage for the doctrinal, you take it for the spiritual lesson involved. So that's what Paul's about to do here. So he says in verse 22, but as it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondmaid, the other by a free woman. That's Hagar and Sarah. But he was of the bondwoman, was born after the flesh, but he of the free woman by promise. Now just stop and think of that story. What happens? Sarah can't have any children, so she tells Abraham, take my bondwoman, take my handmaid. In those days, that handmaid belonged to you, all right? So if she has that baby, you can claim that baby for your own. So she goes ahead and has to do that. But it's a purely fleshly encounter. There's no promise of God in that. All right? It's just a matter of taking a man and a woman, putting them in bed together, and 9 months later, a baby comes out. Sarah's the one who's going to have a baby by promise. She has passed menopause. Okay? And as a result, she's not going to have babies. So when the baby she has isn't going to come by the flesh, it's going to come by promise. Verse 24, which things are an allegory. For these are the two covenants, the one from the Mount Sinai, which gendereth the bondage, which is Hagar. So he said, let's look at that as a type. The law is like that hand servant that's the law, and all it can do is give bondage. One of the rules with slavery universally all over the world has been that a child follows its mother, and her status in the law is the child's status in the law. Doesn't matter who their father was. Goes after the mother. That's been a universal law of slavery. Back in the 1850s, when the abolitionists were making the slave owners so mad and everything, there was a lot of abolitionist pamphlets written about how terrible slave owners were to the women slaves, how they just had their way with them and everything. So finally, Governor Hammond of South Carolina wrote a very indignant tract saying what perverts these people in the North are that only think this way and such. And it was very powerful. It was a rebuke to them. Then when Governor Hammond died, they found all his letters to his sons. Him and his sons were all sleeping with the same slave women, and they explained how to handle the children born of it and such. He himself was one of the worst offenders. Imagine that. The very same woman that has to yield to him is yielding to his sons, her children. Their children are slaves and such, and Governor Hammond's writing about how to handle it. But again, that was the cruelty of slavery. So the thing is here, Hagar genders to bondage. That's what the law does. It brings bondage. Verse 25, for this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and answereth to Jerusalem, which now is, and in bondage with her children. But Jerusalem above is free, which is the mother of us all. Okay? That's right. That's that Jerusalem above. That's the womb of the morning of Psalm 110. Okay? The mother of us all. It's where the actual new birth takes place. Just in case you're wondering. That's the womb put into the person. But verse 26, but Jerusalem which is above is free, which is the mother of us all. Verse 27, for it is written, rejoice thou barren that bearest not. Break forth and cry, thou that travailest not. For the desolate hath many more children than she that hath an husband. That was one of the promises. Paul's saying, look, that promise is answered in the new birth. That promise is answered when people get out of the law and they're born again from that Jerusalem which is above. All right, the promises of God. When you're born of the promises of God and you're not born after the flesh.
Also something else too, I just realized. When Hagar had her baby was the first one that Abraham had out of two of them. Our sin nature is the very first one.
That's right. It's exactly that. In other words, when you begin to follow an allegory and typology, you'll see that it goes on and on. Eventually it'll stop. Eventually you come to a point where you can't take it any further. But it'll go a long ways. All right. Verse 28. Now we brethren, as Isaac was, are the children of promise. So what made Isaac and Ishmael different? Ishmael is born after the flesh. Isaac's born of promise. Okay. A Christian is born of promise. He's not to be under the things of the law. Verse 29, but as then he that was born of the flesh persecuted him that was born of the spirit, even so it is now. In other words, what happened back then? Why did Hagar and Ishmael get kicked out? Because Sarah saw him persecuting the baby, 13 years old. And you know, and he's mocking the child and such. And Sarah says, just kick them out. All right, get them out of here. So what happened to with the believers? The Jews under the law persecuted them. Okay, it's the same thing happened. Timothy?
Does that go with the one Sunday school lesson that you taught where if the Jews that did believe in the law and they followed the law and God saw that, and then when they heard the message of the promise, when they heard the New Testament reckoning of it, and they rejected it, but they were kicked out?
Yeah, what Timothy has asked here, he's gone back to a Sunday school lesson. A Jew who had been under the law before Jesus Christ came, and during the time when he's first growing up, that Jew under the law, who does believe the promises of God. In other words, if he died, he'd go to heaven, okay? When Jesus Christ finally manifests himself to him, that Jew better make the right decision. He better not try to go back to the blood of bulls and goats, okay? He's trampling the blood of Jesus Christ afresh, okay, by doing that. That man there was in danger of losing his salvation. He's not a normal born-again person. He's in that transition. Stephen?
Do you think that group of people are the only people ever that could have lost their
salvation? I doubt it.
Do you think salvation in the Old Testament?
There's people born today in Black Creek who, if they died today, would go to heaven, but may end up in hell. Babies.
Oh.
Okay.
I guess my question was, if you lost your salvation in the Old Testament?
I believe you could. All right?
How? Yeah. That's certainly not any small sin.
I don't think so either. But there, go into Ezekiel, he talks about it. I think Ezekiel 33.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. I just know Jesus Christ told the Pharisees, if I had not come, you would have had a cloak for your sin.
That's why I thought maybe it's only then.
And that, it could be there was only then. He says, but because I've come, ye shall die in your sins.
That's interesting. Does that mean because when the high priest prophesies of Jesus Christ, was he a true Israelite and being rejected?
No. He is by no means has Bible salvation at that point. But yet God so on. That's why Paul says the gifts and the calling of God are without repentance. That's why even when David was anointed, he still calls Saul the anointed of God and he won't touch him. Okay? That's really why the devil, even Michael the archangel says the Lord rebuke thee. He won't rebuke him. He's still the anointed of God. Okay?
I guess the question was then the Pharisees saying you would have had a cloak for your sin. And the Old Testament is that cloak for the sin. The Pharisees were the Pharisees, true Israelites indeed. But then when they saw Jesus were so angered and were covetous over their own position that they mocked.
There are certainly some like that. He's saying to the Pharisees, did they have that cloak? I'm sure there are many who did, okay? You know, I'm sure each one would be an individual. I don't think you'd take the whole group, but I'm sure there's some who did believe in the promises of God, but then threw that away and their decision about Jesus Christ.
What you mentioned is you go to chapter 3, that you're mainly referring to verses 4 and 5, because that's mainly what I see you saying right now.
Read 4 and 5 out loud.
Then whosoever heareth the sound of the trumpet and taketh not warning, if the sword came and taken away, his blood shall be upon his own head.
All right, that's it's really the whole passage. Then he'll go on and explain that whole passage, all right? You'd have to read the whole thing in context, but yes, you started on the right road there, okay? All right. Let's go back to verse 30. Nevertheless, what saith the scripture? Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. Grace and law cannot inherit together. Okay? It just isn't going to happen. So then, brethren, we are not children of the bondwoman, but of the free. We're children of that new Jerusalem above, the promises of God, the promises to Abraham, the promises through Jesus Christ. That's what we're children of. Miss Tanya?
So they both inherit, but they one inherits the bondage, one inherits the promises.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. That's why there's still animal sacrifice in the millennial temple. You know, all that way, you'll find that in Ezekiel. All right, so chapter 5. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage. So he's saying, all right, God's made you free, now stand fast in that liberty. Don't let people tangle you up and all this other stuff. You know, one of the things that happens consistently over and over again, if you read about Israel, when they get into the promised land, Joshua's dead. Over and over and over again, they get themselves tangled up. Over and over again, God has to send a savior to them. Some judge that'll come and kill their enemies and judge them for a while. And then they fly straight for a while. Then they're all entangled again. If you watch a new believer for the first 10, 15 years, that's just their life, all right? Just over and over again, getting tangled in nonsense and such. And then God having to come along and chase them and get them out of it. Verse 2, wherefore I, Paul, say unto you, that if ye be circumcised, Christ shall profit you nothing. Okay. Now does that mean that down at Olean Hospital, if a woman elects to circumcise her son, that Jesus Christ is no profit to? No, it's talking about if you go to get ceremonially circumcised under the law, thinking this will help you, Christ isn't helping you at all. You're in the wrong boat. You know, there's no blessings in that whatsoever. Verse 2, behold, I, Paul, say unto you that if ye be circumcised, Christ shall profit you nothing. For I testify again to every man that is circumcised that he is a debtor to do the whole law. In other words, you want to go ahead and do that? You go follow every single thing in that law if that's what you want to do. Don't sit there and pick and choose things that will. It's what the Seventh-day Adventists do. They kind of conveniently pick and choose what they want out of the law and then look down their nose at you because you don't follow the same things they picked and chose. All right? If you're going to do one thing, do it all. Verse 4, Christ has become no effect unto you. Whosoever of you are justified by the law, you are fallen from grace. In other words, and a lot of people used to take that as, oh, look, they lost their salvation. That is not what that's saying, okay? In other words, what's happened now is you're allowing your old nature to run you, okay? One of the things the old nature sooner or later loves to do is pretend to be the new nature. It learns to be religious. It learns to, you know, it learns to be the Pharisee or whatever. And Paul's saying, if you're trying to be right with God by following the law, you're not under grace right now. Grace isn't running your relationship with God. That's not what's doing it. Verse 5, for we through the Spirit wait for the hope of righteousness by faith. Okay? What is the hope of righteousness by faith? What is that hope? It's the rapture. Yeah. It's him coming to get you. Verse 6, for in Jesus Christ neither circumcision availeth anything nor uncircumcision, but faith that worketh by love. Okay? So, whether a guy's circumcised or uncircumcised, whether a woman's got a circumcised or uncircumcised husband, that has nothing to do with their relationship with Jesus Christ. What works is faith that worketh by love. What do you mean? It's a faith that God has given, and when it's there, it causes love, and you can't help but love, okay? It's going to cause it. It's going to make it happen. You remember what you said to me 3 weeks after your mother got saved? He came to me and he said, my mother has become loving. It's just like stunning to him. He just said it like a wonderment. My mother has become loving. Why? Faith which worketh by love. He'd never known that. Those testimonies mean a lot more to me when outsiders come up and tell me things. A lot of the testimonies come out of people's mouths. But other people come up and they're in wonderment over something. So he goes on and he says, verse 7, ye did run well. Who did hinder you that you should not obey the truth? In other words, you started out, you were doing fine. Who got in your way? Who screwed you up like a Chinese fire drill? This persuasion cometh not of him that calleth you. A little leaven leaveneth the whole lump. You don't have to let a lot of bad teaching in before it screws everything up, okay? It just does. You know, Brother McVeigh comes out of really one of the better churches that Pennsylvania's had. Pastor Richard Black Sr., just a man of God. And so many of the young people from his church, there was just strength to it. I remember I watched him build character in Tim McVeigh. I watched the change in that character. But one of the things they're firm on is they don't believe the King James Bible is perfect. They just don't believe that, okay? They believe that the Greek and Hebrew behind it was perfect. They're not some, they don't go to the New Bibles, but they think you could play with a translation of a King James Bible. And, you know, if you listen to them preach, you think, well, it hasn't affected anything. But you know what? When they looked for a new pastor, that became the preeminent thing. And they began to just bring bozos in. Just crazy guys. And I told McVeigh, I said, that little leaven now has leavened the whole lump. It's leavened the whole thing. Whereby that whole church is about to be washed down the road because of that little bit of leaven in there. And again, pray, because it looks like a door may be open for Brother McVeigh again. So it goes on and it says this, verse 10, I have confidence in you through the Lord, that ye will be none otherwise minded, but he that troubleth you shall bear his judgment, whosoever he be. So the thing is, you don't want to be a person that's mixing up struggling baby Christians. You don't want to be a person that's sowing false doctrine into a church. You don't want to be that person, okay? He will bear his judgment, whosoever he is. He'll bear his judgment for that. Verse 11, and I, brethren, if I yet preach circumcision, why do I yet suffer persecution? Then is the offense of the cross ceased. In other words, if I came to you and said, oh, you know, just go ahead and get circumcised and such, and he says, why am I being persecuted? I'm being persecuted because I'm not telling you that. Now, I'm going to say something, and this is a double entendre for anybody who knows what that means. Double entendre, something that could be taken two different ways. Verse 12, I would that they were even cut off which trouble you. Okay, what are they dealing with? Circumcision. It can be taken both ways. Cut off the men that are saying it. It's my understanding, in English, that's exactly a double entendre. It's my understanding in Greek, it's a double entendre. It can go both ways. It can mean the men or it can mean the privy member, either one. But it's fascinating the way Paul said that. He'd rather a man castrated than get himself circumcised. And he would that those Jews were cut off, those people that are saying that.
That's why he said the way he is. He wanted them to think about it in their own way.
Verse 13, for brethren, ye have been called unto liberty. Only use not liberty for an occasion of the flesh, but by love serve one another. Now again, you have liberty. You have to be so careful with the liberty that you have. Okay? You might tell us, you might, there are certain things you might laugh at, consider funny, or a TV show you might watch or something. You have liberty to do it. You and God are fine with it. Be very careful around other people. Not being a hypocrite, not being somebody who's trying to hide, but at the same time, be careful you don't cause another person to stumble, okay? You know, and what they see is your liberty and your liberty. There's a very dear woman out in Washington State, again, who writes to me fairly often now over the website, different questions and everything. I'm assuming a much older woman than I am and such, but I had called the ESV the extra smelly version, and she was very offended by that. She doesn't like the ESV. You know what I told her? I said, I'm guilty of being too flip with what I said. And I went back to that blog post and I erased that. Why? Because most of the people who, you know, read behind me, that's just meat for the, you know, the raw meat for the dogs. They love it or whatever. But you know what? It offended that woman. And, you know, I took it out of there. I used my liberty, and it was an occasion for the flesh there. She stumbled at what I wrote there. And I thought to myself, I need to be more careful about what I write. Even though 99% of the people who read behind me, that wouldn't have offended. Here's that one woman out there reading this. She's got a husband in the wrong version. She's struggling in this stuff. And I put something there to offend her. And, you know, the Lord just showed me, you can't do that.
So occasionally you have to cater to the offended person?
In other words, there's a few rules. If you have a chain, it can never pull anything heavier than the weakest link can handle. Okay? If you have a group of ships traveling together, they have to go the speed of the slowest ship. You can't make the slowest ship go the speed of the fastest ship. Okay? And when a group of Christians are going together, you have to be careful that you don't run away and leave behind the one that's weak. Okay? You have to be careful of that. I'm not going to put up with nonsense and foolishness. I'll put up for a while with somebody that's got some quirk or whatever, and I'll take some time to teach them. Some people don't want to be taught, okay? Yeah, Nick and I were talking about that. He'll get arguing with people on the internet. You're famous for that, arguing people on the internet. But the point is, 99.99% of them don't want the truth. Mm-hmm. They're so proud of what they believe and, you know, and such, and... you know, that's just where they're at. They don't want the truth. So if somebody comes in, they've got some goofy thing or whatever, I'll wait a while. You know, I'm not going to just go and test them with it. But after a while, when I've laid a foundation and I've tried and they don't want to see it, I'm not going to worry about it anymore. They're willfully blind, and that's a different thing. A weak person, my heart's tender to them. A willfully blind person, my heart is not tender. It goes on, it says this. Verse 13 again. For brethren, ye have been called unto liberty. Only use not liberty for an occasion of the flesh, but by love serve one another. Okay? In other words, treat people like you love them, like you care for them. All right? You know, if you were nursing a child laying in bed with broken bones and fever and hurting, you'd be so tender to that child or whatever else. Well, sometimes Christians are in that condition. Treat them in that condition. By love, serve one another. Handle them that way and such. If you find out later, you know, one of the grossest things I've heard of in a long time, some guy made arrangement with some nursing place where they'd hire out nurses for a little while and said, you know, hey, there's an adult, you know, in adult diapers or whatever, can't help himself. And this woman came there and cleaned the man all up and everything. She found out later he's just a pervert and such. And, you know, she sued him for it. Just, oh, what an awful, sick thing to do, you know, and such. You know, no one would mind if it's a man really hurt and he can't move or whatever else. You know, it's gross, but you'll help the person. Then find out later he's just a pervert laying there tricking nurses into coming doing that. Well, the thing is, you have people in church, some of them really wounded. You don't mind. Let's go up. Then after a while, you find out people that just love to be sick and hurting. All right? They don't want to get better. They just want everybody to feel sorry for them and to help them and such. And after a while, you know, you kick them in the butt. Lou Holtz, the famous football coach, you know, he taught, you know, whenever college football players are playing, they're always dreaming about scouts watching them. Will I get drafted? Will I be on the next Sports Illustrated cover and such? And he talked one time about one of the players that got knocked out on the field. When they get knocked out, I mean, both teams stop. You'll see players huddled on different sides praying together and such. They're all worried about it. And, you know, the doctor runs out there and everybody's running out there. The game stops and the announcers are all worried and such. And they run out there, and the doctor's kind of slapping the boy's face. And the first thing they ask him is, you know, what's your name, what's your number, what position do you play? You know, they want to make sure he's cognizant. The kid goes, who wants to know? Lou said, I kicked him, told him to get up. But again, you're going to have people in the church who love to be the limping, wounded person. And you know what? Nobody minds that when we're limping and wounded, all right? Nobody minds that. But at the same time, there's nothing worse to be than a person who just loves to be the limping, wounded person. It's an awful thing for you personally to be that way. 14. All right, 14. For all the laws fulfilled in one word, even in this, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. If you did that, you wouldn't break any of the Ten Commandments. You would, if you loved your neighbor like you love yourself, you know, it would be fulfilled. You'd be doing everything God ever wanted. Verse 15. But if you bite and devour one another, take heed that ye be not consumed one of another. And let me tell you something. Every one of you has been in a family, been in a group, been in a workplace, been in a church where they began biting and devouring one another. Okay? That's just absolute living hell. It's just a terrible place to be. You know, you're up one day and got it over your enemy, and the next day they have it over you, and you know, it's an awful place to be. Don't ever let that happen in a church. If you begin to see it happening, you be the person to stop it, okay? Don't wait for someone else to stop it. You stop it. If you can stop it no other way than just shutting your mouth and they realize you're offended, your mouth is shut, don't worry about it, okay? If they're really somebody godly, it's not going to bother them. They might be even ashamed because you did that, okay? But, and if they get mad at you, they're just in the wrong place with God. Verse 16, this I say then, walk in the Spirit, and ye shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. Pretty simple, okay? Two roads to walk on. That one over there has got dog poop all over the place, and this one's clean, all right? You don't want dog poop on your shoes? Walk on that road, all right? If you walk in the Spirit, you won't fulfill the lust of the flesh. You won't do it. You walk in the Spirit of God, do things God's way, all these other things coming up, you won't walk that way. You won't fulfill those things. Then it goes on, says verse 17, for the flesh lusteth against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. What is that? They both want what the other one has. That's what it says. The Spirit wants what your flesh has. It wants to control you. It wants to see that every synod operates under it. That everything you put in your mouth is because the Spirit of God wanted it there. Everything that comes out of your mouth is because the Spirit of God wanted it there. And whenever the flesh is just having its way, the Spirit lusts for that power over you. Lusts to have that, be able to run you, be able to run things. And you want to know something? When the Spirit of God runs you, your conscience is clean. You wake up refreshed. I mean, it's just your life is where it needs it. When awful things happen and they happen to everybody, it doesn't drag you down as far and as awful as it used to drag you down. But when the flesh is running you, oh, you'll have your highs, but you'll also have your lows. You'll have it. But you know,
that also part of the jealousy of God is that he's jealous over wanting that portion that should not have been turned over to that?
Yeah, that's right. He's jealous in that sense. Yeah. There's an analogy I use, and I've never forgotten it. Before, I think Ruth Ann was pregnant with our first born, and we stopped at a woman's house that had 8 children. And gosh, her youngest now, probably 50. But this is a good 35 years ago, but she had 8 children. And remember, you know, when a woman's about to have her first baby, there's all these questions in her mind, things she wants to know and such. And she asked the woman about the difference between breastfeeding and bottle feeding. And the woman said, well, with my 8 children, I've done both. She said there were times I just couldn't breastfeed for some health problem or whatever. Ended up having to bottle feed. There's others I could breastfeed them. And she says, you want to know what? They both grew, just both healthy. They all seemed to thrive. She said, but if I were to notice a difference, she said, both of them would get the flu when the flu came through. But the ones that were breastfed could kick it just like that. Just like that. But the ones that were bottle fed, that flu would just hang on forever. colds would come, those that are breastfed, they'd get a cold just like the others, but they'd just knock it right off. The ones who are bottle-fed, that cold would just last forever, okay? You want to live after the flesh? Same things will happen to you that happen to people who live after the Spirit. It's what happens to you afterwards, how well you recover from it, that makes the difference, okay? There are certain people just can't get over certain things. Dale and I were dealing with a woman that probably about 20 years ago had a son of hers killed and probably murdered, okay? And the people who did it probably slapped God away with it. And very bitter about that. She's just an alcoholic, just drinks herself to death, living with the skeggiest people on earth and such. It's just a terrible, terrible thing. But when you try to deal with it, you don't know what it's like, you know, and she goes back to that thing. Yeah, I'll bet it was awful. But it was awful to have a son die like that. And, you know, where everybody's pretty sure it's murder, but you couldn't nail anybody with it. I'll bet you it was pretty awful. Okay? But I know people came out of concentration camps with a lot worse, and they're not drunk every day living with stoners. Okay? You know, it's what you do with that. And you'll have people using, but this happened to me, that's why I'm acting that way. I go find people that had worse happen to them. They're not doing what you're doing. Okay? You know why you're doing what you're doing? Because you want to do what you're doing. That's an excuse for you to do what you're doing. Okay? No matter what you've got, again, I've told people, no matter what excuse you want to use for why you're a loser in life, I can take the dot, your birth certificate, your social security card, your driver's license, I can take it to Vietnam, Africa, the Caribbean, down in South America, give those to somebody, and they'll come here, and they could have gone through worse than you, be more crippled than you, or whatever else, and they will win in life, all right? All they need is to document you. They'll win in life. You know why? Because they want to win. They don't want to sit around and cry in their beer all day. Oh, this happened to me, you know. Okay, it happened to you. Get up and get over it, okay? Be done with it. It is awful.
Wallowing doesn't fix it.
What's that?
Wallowing in your pain doesn't fix the pain.
No, but there's people who just get used to wallowing in the pain, okay? And there comes a point. You got to let it go, all right? Are you just going to be that person? You know, it goes back to Barry Rackley's message, letting Jesus touch your issues. The woman with the issue of blood, what was her name? We don't know. All we know is her issue, okay? And he just said, many people in church are in danger of that. Randy?
So what do you do with the people who genuinely don't know how to let anything go?
You have to be careful. A, they could drag your life down. You may have to separate from them, okay? You have to be very careful what your relationship is with them and how much time you spend with them, because they can drag your life down. They can do that. They can get you to the point where you're thinking that way all the time. I wouldn't be uncompassionate with them. But, you know, if it just comes to a point that's all they want, no matter what goes on, you spend the least amount of time you can with them. I think you have some people in your family that way. You know what? Show them honor when it's time to show them honor. But you better be careful. You don't get dragged down in that. You've done a good job. Okay, I'll bear witness to the world. He's done a good job. Okay, he's done a real good job.
Well, that's partially true.
That's right. And I kick your butt for everything on that other part, don't I? But you've done a good job. You know why I don't? You know why you're still living in my house? Because you're still trying to improve. You're still trying to get things better. You still go out and working every day. I never have to go and kick you out of bed and tell you it's time to go to bed. Never have to, you know, get you to do that stuff or get you to pay your bills. You do that stuff, all right? And such. And yeah, you still got problems. You still got stuff screwy. So's Tim. So's Sam, all right? But the point is, you're doing a good job. And there were some rough things that got thrown at you in life. But why do we put up with you? Because you're not wallowing in the mud. You're not sitting there crying like a baby over all the stuff that happened to you.
Advice, I know
who he was. Yeah, that oddly reminds me, a few years back, you once asked me in a car ride, you said, I noticed with you, Randy, you thrive on an equal bit of joy and pain. And you asked me, why is that? And I simply said to you, much like a coin, can't have one without the other.
But you can. Doesn't have to be, you know, if this arm feels good, you have to burn the other.
Let me put it this way. As your life as a preacher, if you didn't went through the hell you did in the past, could you state what you can today?
No. And that's what Paul says in 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians, he says, you go through what you go through so that you can help others going through the same thing. Okay. The point is, there is both pain and there is good times. But it doesn't have to be 50-50. Okay. It doesn't have to be an equal amount. I know people who actually kind of like happy over the, oh, it's raining again. Oh, my headache's back. Oh, you know, it's almost like they enjoy, you know, this. The Jews have a word for that. Hoi. Hoi, they call it. Hoi. And, you know, that woman that just, oh, you know, I'm a little burny. You're going out again. Hoi. You know? And they call it hoi, that just kind of whining, complaining and such.
Neat.
All right.
The Jews have a word for
everything. The Jew, yeah, they do. All right. So the thing is, read 17 again. For the flesh lusteth against the spirit against the flesh. And these are contrary the one to the other, so that you cannot do the things that you would. Okay? What's would mean? It means what you will to do. What's hindering you? You know, is there anybody here who wouldn't like to be in perfect physical shape? You know, maybe go out and get a doctorate in three different disciplines and such. Well, why don't you get that done? Okay, because this battle's going on, all right? This thing's going on with you and such. And, you know, and so you don't do the things that you would. You can't do the things that you would. And that's why it takes a lot more to make you do what you're supposed to than you realize, okay? Too many people compromise on a very low level of life, okay? You don't need to do that, okay? Timothy and Michael, and I've been listening to some. I think John Mark and Stephanie have been listening to it. There's a professor out of the University of Toronto by the name of Jordan Peterson, who's a secularist. Secularist. In other words, when he gives counsel, he's not giving counsel on the Bible. He's giving counsel from more secular, non-Bible, biblical ways and such. But at the same time, he's just talking about this idea. He said, do you realize when people get transplants, that most transplants will work if they take their medicine, but they have a hard time making a transplant person take their medicine? And he says, isn't that odd? And he said the same person, when their dog needs medicine, makes sure that dog always has the medicine. But they themselves don't take the things they need. And he said part of the whole problem in life is learning to treat yourself like you would somebody you loved, like somebody you had care for, and such, and learning how to do that, okay? Why don't you? Because these conflicts are going on inside of you, all right? So that you actually find yourself going long periods of time neglecting the number one person you were put in charge of, okay? You know, and you're not taking care of that person. And you know, and it's just, you know, it's a stunning thing. It's a lot of fun to listen to, you know? It is. This guy, he's a lot of fun. It's the Liberals so hate him in Canada that if a university professor quotes him, they'll actually fire them from their job.
Wow.
Yeah. They so hate him and such. And the thing is, it's just good old common sense he's talking about. He'll use all, he'll take you all these things, and when he can bring them back, it's just common sense.
Boy.
Yeah.
How is it you can get something so petty as to fire someone just for bringing up a name, get them fired, and that's just A-OK.
It's just the world we live in now, Randy. Uh-huh. We do. We live in a world where free speech is on the edge. All right.
Apparently.
All right. Tell you what. We're going to stop right there. John Vadas, would you close us in prayer?